I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There's been an increase in recent years in the number of women in prison on parole and probation. That's according to the Sentencing Project. Our guest, Susan Burton, was one of those women sent to prison six times over the course of almost 20 years for drug-related offenses. After getting therapy for her drug addiction and for the traumas in her life, Burton never went back. Instead, she started her nonprofit, A New Way of Life, providing shelter and services for women released from prison, and she's been honored and recognized for her work. She's written a memoir with Carrie Lynn, Becoming Ms. Burton, about the violence and abuse in her childhood that set her on a path of self-destruction, her prison experiences, and her work to reform the criminal justice system. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Susan Burton, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
You're very welcome. Well, nice to have you here. And I have to say, having read your book yesterday, it upset me. And it upset me to read about you as a little girl, the kind of abuse and violence that you had to endure, the sense that I got that you were alone and vulnerable. Was it hard to write that?
There was a period while I was writing the book that it seemed like the world of sadness was enveloping me in a bubble. And to think that this could happen, and it happens too frequently to girls. But the sadness that just sat there with me for a good while, so I had to step back and breathe a bit in order to continue writing the book.
Do you think your story, and I do want to get into some of the details, but also the work that you do as well, but do you think your story is similar to other women who have been or are incarcerated?
Yes, it is. Barbara Bloom, sociologist, has documented that over 65% of women incarcerated self-disclose childhood abuse, childhood molestation, and being exposed to violence as a little girl or a young woman. So those are those that self-disclose. In At A New Way of Life, we have conversations about what happens or what has happened as a child with the women that we house there. And it's well into the 90% of those women who have experienced abuse as a child.
You know, reading about you as a little girl, your aunt's boyfriend would abuse you. And you describe in some detail about what it was like to ride to the facility where he was living, knowing that he was going to get into the car with you, knowing what was going to happen to you, and how you sort of mentally would leave your life in order to endure what he did.
Yes. As a small child, you know, I learned this technique to actually remove myself, I guess, emotionally, spiritually, from my body that, you know, I would be there, but I wouldn't be there. And that was a skill that I developed and used throughout my life. And when writing the book, I thought about how did I stay sane through all of this? And it might have been a large part of it because of this skill. Because I work with women, and many times, you know, they've developed different diagnoses as a result of perhaps the trauma and the abuse that they've endured throughout their life. And I seem to have came out of it a bit stronger, savvier, and able to stand up and fight and allow these services and environment that helps people, helps women who have been incarcerated heal and stand with me.
Did you ever feel as a little girl that there was someone in your corner, someone who could protect you or that you could turn to when you felt either violated or in danger?
No, I felt as though I had to figure it out.
Even as a little girl, to figure it out.
Even as a little girl, because, you know, you read in the book, when this violation was exposed, my auntie demonized me as a four-year-old for what was happening and threatened me not to ever say anything. So, you know, I had to figure it out.
She called you a dirty little girl. You were 4 years old.
Yes, she did.
I mean, that's so painful.
Yeah, and, you know, I know this was done to me, but somehow I feel so bad for her that this is the way she responded instead of protecting me as a little girl from her, what I want to say, crazy boyfriend, because we picked him up at Camarillo State Mental Hospital, where he was sent. You know, I didn't know he was crazy as a little girl, but now I know what Camarillo State Hospital is. It's a mental facility. So I feel bad that she responded that way. And, you know, it might have been a part of the culture in which she came from, the Deep South. And, you know, my parents and their siblings fled there, trying to come to California for a better life. But what they brought with them was much of what they had been subject to and what they had learned in that Deep South environment. You know, the 30s, the 20s, the 20s, 30s, and 40s. So they arrived in Los Angeles in the late 40s.
That's very forgiving of you, I have to say.
Well, I have found that being unforgiving, you carry a heavy weight with you. And I don't need that weight weighing me down in the work that I have to do today. And so I think the highest road and the best road for me is to not forget, but to forgive and move forward with my life.
You describe going to prison, which you did over the course of, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years. You were in prison about six times. Did you learn anything in prison, either about yourself or about prison?
I learned that prison is a place. I learned that the prison system is very cruel, very cruel, very unforgiving, and that it will exploit the individuals who are kept there, who are sent there. I remember working for them for 8 cents an hour on farms and on crews and in kitchens and being trained to fight fires, that on the front line of a fire you get $1 an hour. So I learned that it's a very cruel place.
You've been out of prison for 20 years, and one of the things that you describe in your book is talking to a friend who told you about a treatment center in Santa Monica, California, and it seems like that is the place that provided the kind of care and services that you need, but it also seemed the place that acknowledged who you were, your pain.
Yes. So I arrived in Santa Monica at a treatment facility October 4th of 1997. And I stayed there 100 days. And in those 100 days, I began the process of healing, and I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I discovered a mechanism that was very effective for me to begin to address my childhood trauma, the loss of my son.
Killed by, in a car accident, hit by a car,
Yeah. And that's where I began the process of learning even to forgive. So I couldn't understand why I had been sent to prison six times for possession of a drug that I used to medicate my grief, my pain, my loss, and the trauma I had endured for most of my life. And here there was a solution in a way that was empowering and grounding and effective. When the sentences to prison was so ineffective and so harsh and so cruel, and that spurred me to think about the other women that needed just what I had gotten there in Santa Monica. And I brought that back to South L.A., where so many women were coming back from the prison system and needed just a safe place to go to start their lives.
Is that where Go ahead.
Yeah. So to date, we have helped over 1,000 women there come back in into one of our homes. There, I started with my home, which is one home that I lived in, and now we have 5 homes, and again, over 1,000 women have came back, and over 300 children have been reunited with their parent there in those homes.
I do want to pick up on that, and we have a break in about a minute. But when did you become Ms. Burton?
I became Ms. Burton through the journey of, you know, realizing myself, standing up in the community, welcoming these women, the women back into the community, and all of a sudden they were calling me Ms. Burton.
Feels good, doesn't it?
It does feel good, yes.
Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Ms. Burton, Susan Burton. We've been talking about her work. She started a nonprofit about 20 years ago called A New Way of A New Way of Life, working to provide shelter and services, emotional support for women released from prison. And she writes about all of this in her new book. It's called Becoming Ms. Burton. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We've got two guests who are waiting in the wings. I also want to open the lines. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about resources available to women inside and outside prison, some of the challenges they face when reentering society, and what to do to keep them out of prison. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I've been talking with Susan Burton about her life, her work with women released from prison, and her book, Becoming Ms. Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. And joining us are Jean Friedman Rudofsky. She's project editor of the Reentry Project, and that's a Philadelphia-based collaborative that includes WHYY, focused on finding workable solutions for recidivism and reentry. She's also a freelance journalist. And Jean Friedman Rudofsky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Marie Gottschalk, and she's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies mass incarceration and criminal justice. She's written a bunch of books. Her most recent one is Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. And Marie Gottschalk, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Jean, let me get you in on the conversation. And Ms. Burton, Susan Burton, I want to make sure that you're part of the conversation as well. I know that you are up there in New York. But Jean, when you listen to Susan's story, does it sound like some of the stories that you've heard here in Philadelphia?
It does. It sounds like a lot of stories that are based right here in Philadelphia. You know, the issues that Susan dealt with her in her life, the issues that the women who she helps at a New Way of Life reentry project out in LA are very similar to what happens here. You have issues of sexual trauma and assault in childhood. You have issues of drug addiction and alcoholism. You have challenges when women get out of, you know, not having a house to live in, not having a home to go home to. And that's why Susan's project is so exceptional, because she provides them with a place to live. Trouble reconnecting with their children. You know, it's all of the challenges that men face, plus a lot of others.
And I do want to pick up on all of that. And I should say to you, Susan, that Jean did a story about you 3 years ago in Cosmopolitan magazine, just to make sure our listeners know that you two have met before.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I remember. Yes.
Marie, let me turn to you. And part of my introduction was that there is an increase in the number of women going to prison who are on probation and parole. Why? What explains that? Why are we seeing that?
The war on drugs has hit women harder than it's hit men. And so, in state prisons nationwide, 16% of the people are there for drug offenses, but disproportionately they're women, and they're disproportionately women of color. So in that way, we've seen a dramatic increase in women. So they're starting from a lower base, but the fastest growing population today is women.
And is it women using drugs, women selling drugs?
And what happens in the drug laws is often that if you are a courier, a low-level person, you don't have any information significant to give the prosecutors. So when mandatory minimums hit, they hit you hardest, where if you're the boyfriend or the dad, you're a higher-level person in the drug operation, you can give something to prosecutors. They can make a case for a lower sentence for you. So you often have women who are quite low-level getting much more serious offenses when they may not be that significant in the operation.
Susan, let me turn back to you. From your experience, your time in prison, was that true? The other women there, was it largely for drug offenses?
Yes, the majority of women were there for drug offenses, and you know, while there, they didn't do anything to address the addiction, and therefore we cycled in and out. You know, I want to bring up that during these times that the numbers of women increased in incarceration, there was this kind of rhetoric coming out of the White House around welfare queens and crack mothers that began to like demonize the women who were, you know, victims of the drug war. And I think the general public kind of moved to not think about the humanity and the humanity of the women who were caught up, kind of turned their backs and walked away.
Well, and I wonder whether that, and you're nodding your head, Jean, but whether that speaks to just a perspective, a stereotype about a woman using drugs, and in many cases, as Susan described, you know, losing their children or wanting their children back. And we look at women differently than we do men.
We really do. And when I mentioned that women who are returning from prison deal with the challenges that men have, plus a few more, I would say that one of those added ones is this sort of problem of stigma, right? Women are supposed to be carers. They're supposed to take care of their kids. They're not supposed to do bad things. They're supposed to be good people. You know, we're sort of kind-hearted beings. That's the stereotype of women. And so when a woman is incarcerated, the reaction to that is almost sort of one of, well, you betrayed who you really should be. You know, you betrayed your kids. You betrayed your family. You shouldn't be doing those things. There's kind of an excuse for men, but not for women. And so it's really incredibly challenging, I think, for women who are coming out to connect back with their families, to connect with other people in the communities, because they face this sort of heightened stigma.
Well, Marie, I want to go back to you, but let me just go back to you, Susan, first, only because you write about your daughter, Toni.
Yes.
Your mother raised her. I mean, at one point, your mother said that you were a bad mother, in a sense, a bad seed, as a way to sort of, turn your daughter against you. But you talk in great detail and with great honesty and I'm sure difficulty about what it was like or what it has been like to rebuild your relationship, to get over all the feelings that she naturally had to feel as a little girl.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I know. I have to say that my daughter's here with me in New York now.
Great.
And we're having a great time here. And I'm so glad the children and the families of those incarcerated, you know, are hurt just as much as the person that you're incarcerating. So you incarcerate a person, you also incarcerate the family, you also, the child also gets hurt in that. And yes, my mother and my community bought into the stereotyping that Jean just sort of talked about and, you know, deemed people bad people. So we are on a, I don't want to call it a crusade, but we are on a march to be, to stand and reclaim our humanity, our purpose, to fight for the right to just be in America, to end the discrimination and to, you know, walk side by side with one another and, you know, change that. My mother, my daughter, my community, they brought into all of that.
Let me get you back in on the conversation. You study mass incarceration. What has been the effect of mass incarceration on families, on children?
It's had a traumatic effect on children. What we know is that many children have major depression. They have difficulties in school. They have lifelong feelings of trauma and of loss and of grief, and that it is an expanding population of kids who will grow up having had one or two parents incarcerated. The effects on moms are greater because often they are the primary parent, and we have laws for the last couple of decades that terminate parents' parental rights after a relatively short period of time. Sometimes it can be 15 or 18 months, and you're at risk of losing your children permanently.
We certainly went through a tough on crime period, and I think that's largely when Susan was serving time until 1997 for about 20 years. And the current Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, seems to be talking more law and order of charging crimes and of maybe reigniting the drug war. I mean, it never exactly went away. But
well, that's the point, right? The rhetoric changed, but mass incarceration has not changed. And that for all the talk about a new way of thinking in terms of public safety and in terms of public health and drug crimes, we've seen really a stabilization of incarceration rates and not a dramatic drop in incarceration rates. And as Ms. Burton was talking about the welfare queens, the crack addicts, that was very racialized language. We're now seeing that language being reinvented for the war on migrants in the country and also the war on rural women now. The fastest growing population are white women in rural areas in the opioid crisis. So people are saying that we have this public health understanding, but the data is not there, that we're actually being quite punitive to people in the opioid crisis.
So, 'cause one of the things that I had heard was that we incarcerated crack users, but for opioids, we're looking for therapy, but you're saying not so much.
We're talking about that, and we can see that in the recent prosecutor's race here in Philadelphia, that we have our Pennsylvania Prosecutors Association, who at one level is talking we need good Samaritan laws if people overdose. On the other hand, they're supporting more mandatory minimums to deal with the opioid crisis. And if we're going to do more mandatory minimums, we're not going to have more money for the programs that Ms. Burton is supporting, like substance abuse programs.
Let me just reintroduce everybody. That's Marie Gottschalk. She's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies incarceration, mass incarceration. Also with us, Jean Friedman Rudofsky. She's project editor of the Reentry Project, working to find workable solutions for recidivism and dealing with the problem of reentry. Certainly recidivism is high across the country, certainly high here in Pennsylvania. And we've also been talking with Susan Burton, and she started a program called A New Way of Life. This was after serving time in prison. It's a nonprofit working with women, providing shelter and services and emotional support. And I see comments coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. Susan, let me go back to you, because one of the things that you do, I don't know if you still do this, but you meet the buses of women who have been released from prison. They're, bused back to their community. You're there at the buses when they get out. Why?
When I first began A New Way of Life, I knew there were women stepping off that bus downtown L.A., downtown Skid Row. And I knew what it would have meant to me if I'd have had some place to go that was safe, that was supportive. So when I got the house, I would go to the bus station and wait for the bus to come in. The buses came in every day delivering people back to Skid Row, to the area of Skid Row, to make a life. And that's how I began to launch A New Way of Life. And now we receive about 25 letters a week from women in the California area and in other parts of the nation, asking for information, asking for a bed there, just wanting to be in touch. Mm. And we respond to all those letters. So I no longer go down to wait on the bus unless I know someone who has written and asked for help is getting off that bus.
What was the response 20 years ago when you stood there and before your program was really known, saying, hey, I've got a home, I've got a house for you?
So there, it was a good response. Some people, you know, I knew, first of all, I knew the women because, you know, I had been traveling in and out of prison for the last 15, 20 years. So I knew the women. And, you know, some people said yes. Some women said no. Some women looked at me warily, you know, kind of.
Who are you, right?
yeah, like, what are you doing? Yeah. But before long, there were 11 of us living in this house. And it was just a beautiful scene to see women supporting one another, crying together, laughing together. Struggling together, sharing, you know, the resources and the information, and all of us on a path to healing.
Jean, let me get you back in on the conversation, thinking about Susan describing her program. I mean, and we're focusing on women this hour. What do they need? What do they want? What works?
Well, I think one of the key things that, which is what Susan says she does now, is she connects with women while they're still on the inside. This is really key. In the reporting that we've done through the Reentry Project and, you know, the data that's out there looking at reentry programs, they work best when you connect with prisoners who are still, while they're still prisoners, while they're still inmates. So reentry starts, you know, before release, so that people who are coming out have a plan, they know where they're going. Ideally, there's been some sort of, you know, individualized assessment, so that you know whether you're dealing with someone who has an addiction to, has a substance abuse problem, has an addiction to alcohol, has issues of sexual trauma in their life, and so that from the very beginning you're getting them the services that they need. I think with women, you know, it's housing, it's therapy, it is recovery programs often. Connecting back with their children. I mean, as Marie talked about, it can be unbelievably difficult for women to connect back with their children. And that's not to say that every single woman wants to connect back
sure.
with her kids, you know,
or just should like, connect,
or
back,
should
with
connect right. back with their kids. That's the other part of this is, you know, family. Sometimes it's wonderful to be able to be released from prison and to go back to your family. 70 to 90% of people nationwide, when they come out, they go back to, you know, the home of a loved one. Sometimes that's the worst possible place that they can go. It's either where the trauma happened, it's where people are still perhaps using the drugs that that person was addicted to before. And so, you know, having a different option is often really important.
I'm wondering about in Pennsylvania today, are there programs in prison to help with reentry and to hopefully prevent some kind of recidivism? Have you found
there are a lot
a
of
cooperative
programs.
Relationship to some degree?
Yes, there are a lot of programs, and it was really interesting that the piece that I did on A New Way of Life and Susan years ago was the first time I did reporting on reentry, and I went in with this kind of assumption that there just weren't that many programs in general for people coming out of prison because we have such a high recidivism rate. How could it be that if there was a plethora? Except that what I found was there actually are a ton of very effective solutions being put into place. I think part of the problem is they're scattered in sort of a labyrinth. I mean, the day-to-day of what a lot of people have to deal with when they're coming out on probation and parole is just remarkable. I mean, between, having to mandatory meetings with their parole officers where they have to go to the parole officer's office, they have required group therapy, they have anger management, they have, all of these different systems, and it can be kind of overwhelming to have to deal with all of that. And so it's much more effective when there's sort of wraparound case
right.
management.
More centralized.
Exactly. And so here in Philadelphia, there are a ton of great programs doing a lot of good work. There's a place called the Reentry Coalition, which is a city-led kind of alliance amongst all of the groups that that are working. And so there are efforts being made to kind of create a more communication, a system, a framework. There's still a long way to go because I think a lot of people are still caught in that labyrinth.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about women being released from prison and what they need, the reentry process, and how to reduce the recidivism rate. And again, that's Jean Friedman Rudofsky, project editor of the Reentry Project, Marie Gottschalk, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania who studies incarceration, and Susan Burton, who spent almost 20 years in and out of prison, started a program in Los Angeles called A New Way of Life for Women Getting Out of Prison. You can join us, text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Susan Burton, Jean Friedman Rudofsky, and Marie Gottschalk about women going into prison, women coming out of prison, what to do to reduce the recidivism rate. And I should add that there are about 250,000 people, obviously some of them women in Pennsylvania, supervised by probation or parole. Marie, let me turn to you. I guess I have the same recidivism question that I was putting to both Susan and to Jean about what do we do to reduce, specifically focusing on women, but what do we do to reduce the level of recidivism, and do we make it too hard for women once they've gotten out of prison?
I would throw out the yardstick of reducing recidivism, that we have a profound misunderstanding of what recidivism is, that we have this misleading idea that two-thirds of the people coming out of prison will recidivate within 3 years. But recidivate can mean going back to prison for a parole or probation violation. It can mean being rearrested, which you're more likely to be if the police swoop into a neighborhood. What we do know is that many of the people coming out of prison have trauma. They have mental health issues. They have substance abuse issues. They need to reconnect with their families. The first 2 weeks that you come out of prison, you have a 13 times higher chance of dying than the general population. You have an over 100 times chance higher of overdosing, and that should be our focus. What we do know about recidivism is that the best programs in prison can only reduce committing real new crimes that are major public threat to society by a small amount. Mm. And that we have this idea that all the people coming out of prison are ready to commit new crimes unless we intervene. And this is a great misrepresentation of the wide population of people coming out of prison. And we had a study here in Pennsylvania a few years ago. We found that 39,000 people came out within 3 years, and only about 149 of them committed a new violent offense that they would have to go back into. So we talk about recidivism as if that's the be-all and the end-all, rather than going back to what Ms. Burton said, is that prisons are cruel, they're exploitative, and they're unforgiving. And in some ways, we need to make it up to the people who are coming back and not make their lives more difficult and keep focusing on if they don't call their parole officer at a right time at 8 o'clock at night, the threat is we're going to bounce you back into the system. They are not a threat to public safety. So I think every time we use the word recidivism, we have to be much more careful about why we're focusing so much on that and what we mean by that.
Susan, I'd love to hear your response to what Marie just said.
I'm going to speak from an I statement.
Sure.
Every time I left prison, I left, you know, with a resolve and a commitment to actually get it together. Because of lack of opportunity, lack of being ready to actually get back into mainstream, no ID, no Social Security card, nowhere to live, you know, desperation and the need to actually survive pushed me to certain areas, to do certain things. It's not because I wanted to, not because I wanted to live that way. I was recently in Arizona, and I went into a state prison there, Perryville State Prison, and I spoke with the women there. And those women there was there, many of them, about 60% of them raised their hand that they were there for technical violation. Wow. You know, not living at the address where they were supposed to be living. Not reporting on time, having a dirty urinalysis. These are things that should not be a weapon to use to send a woman back into prison. So that's what I'm seeing. And in California, there was a report called Breaking Barriers for Women on Parole, did by the Little Hoover Commission. And they documented the types of technical violations that were just rampant. So we fought in California, and those numbers are lower now. But we really need to look at, again, as she said, what we call recidivism. They're technical violations.
Let me ask you, and I don't know what the other word for recidivism is, but let me ask you, though, Susan, you said about 1,000 women have gone through your program. Have most of them been able then to stay out of prison, even with those potential threat of a technical violation?
You know, yes. You know, with the supports, the encouragement, the services that we provide, you know, we have a really high success rate with the women that come to a new way of life. You know, and then they have the ability to learn leadership and advocacy skills where parole is not pushing them around. They're letting parole know that they have a right to be and do place and be places. Like parole can't just say leave your job and come do a UA with me. That they'll lose their job if they can't stay on the job. And these are the types of things that happen within the different supervisory law enforcement areas, parole and probation.
And UA is what urine analysis. I figured that out. Let me turn back to you, Jean. I mean, what does it cost to incarcerate someone in Pennsylvania?
That's a very good question. I think it's between $50,000 to $60,000 a year, I believe. And, you know, at least at the time that I was doing reporting on Susan's program, I'm not sure what the cost is now, Susan. I think it was, you know, closer to between $12,000 to $16,000 a year that you spent per person.
Yes.
And so, you know, we are talking about – clearly this is a – this is a human tragedy, right? You know, our criminal justice system and everything that goes into it. But it also is an economic problem, a very serious economic problem for our cities, for our states, and for our country. And so what's interesting is that, you know, here in Philadelphia, there actually is a push to change some of this, right? So, Marty, I know you've done shows on this.
Yeah.
The MacArthur Grant that the city has been given with the goal of reducing the city's jail population by 35% in 3 years. They're already, you know, almost a year in, and they're about a 12% reduction, which is good. And some of the things that they're looking at is exactly that. Why are people going back in? You know, is it these tiny little violations, and can we change that? And with, you know, the election last night, or the nomination last night of Larry Krasner
for DA
as the Democratic candidate, you know, he has promised to change a lot of these policies that really do fuel, at least in the city jail population, this sort of cycling in and out.
Well, Maria, I'd love to have you respond to that. You talked about the kind of lip service paid to reform. What does it take to get beyond lip service? And is it just we can't afford this anymore, or can we have a more enlightened approach?
I think that the economic issues have opened the conversation, but to create a durable movement over the long term, you're going to have to frame this as a social justice, civil rights issue, and not just as an economic issue. And where we've seen states that have been significant in rolling back this, and district attorneys who have been significant in Milwaukee, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, they have been put together a reform coalition, and they've been willing to go against the dominant forces in the state, which tend to be for more punitive policies. I think we also need to recognize that it's not just an economic cost when you send someone to prison, but even if they didn't have mental health issues before, as we found in the, I served on the National Academy of Sciences Commission on the Causes and Consequences of High Rates of Incarceration, we give people major depression. We give them post-traumatic stress disorder. We give people who didn't have drug problems before drug problems because they've served in the have had the trauma of being incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And so to think that we're addressing this through that, economic opens the conversation, but we need something to understand the kind of moral social justice issues that are associated with it.
Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Carmen: there's no rehab in prison. There's only punishment. I served 5 years in prison, released in 2011, just graduated with a BA from CRMJ. I'm not sure what that is. Still unable to get work. I'm so sorry to hear that, Carmen. Text from Mark: Ms. Burton, have you considered expanding your program to other cities around the country? Here in Philadelphia, I've met too many women who are injured, broken, and whose lives are often spent going through the revolving door of the penal system. They need your help. A tweet from the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project: we would love to hear from Susan Burton about young women under 18 who are sentenced as adults. What do those folks need? Let me just hold those questions out there, and I do want to play someone that called into our comment line.
Hi, my name is Judy. I'm calling from Ambler, Pennsylvania. I have a close relative that was just released from prison yesterday, and she is an opioid addicted person, and she's on the loose, and you know she is prime target for going back to drugs again. Is there a place that I can call and a home that I can get her into until she can get into rehab? Thank you very much.
Let me put that to you, to Eugene.
So I think
literally, I mean, this is an emergency, right?
Right, exactly. So I think the best thing to do really in any of these situations is to contact RISE, which is the city's office. RISE, RISE, which is the city's Office of Reintegration and Reentry. They are, you know, they should be sort of the go-to in situations like these, because there are certainly, you know, tailored programs for what this person might need. I'm not in a place to say exactly what that would be, but RISE would be able to have that information.
And Susan, her call speaks to, I guess, the kind of risk that anyone released from prison has in those first couple of days. When you've been just released from prison and maybe you've given a couple of $100 and you're on your own.
Yes. So what I have proven and what I know is the motto of a new way of life has great success, and it's an effective, the model works. So I'm working with Leap and Associates to do a model replication study, and then create a network of homes across the nation that can begin to welcome people back into the community. And, you know, I work primarily with women, but I'm sure this model will work for men with a couple of tweaks. So that is one of my missions with the book, Becoming Miss Burton, is to identify and create and support the creation of the replication model of a new way of life.
And would you say this model, this approach, takes time, Susan Burton?
Well, I guess putting a project, a program together, you know, it takes that time to put it together. But I think, you know, the model of a new way of life is community. It's single family homes. It's not a big warehouse factory where there's no, it's like a family. We create family connections, close relationships to support one of another. So I don't think it's a real complicated process or, and, you know, I'm very excited about this idea of replication and communities supporting one another to become their best selves.
Marie, do you share some of that optimism that I'm hearing from Susan Burton?
I share the optimism about individual people who can be helped, but I think we can't forget the larger situation of the bigger structural issues, that people, no matter how much they get the programming and the parenting skills and the job skills, many people are going out into communities with 40 or 50% unemployment rates within their areas. And they can't change that. And that, even if you take an anger management class, it's going to make you pretty angry that you go out and that's what you're facing. And so we need to think about these, in the short term and medium term, helping these very abused women and men coming out of prison. But over the long term, we have to say, what are we doing with our resources, that we're locking up more people than any other country in the world, and in Philadelphia, more than any other city in the country, major city in the country.
More than any other.
In proportional terms.
In proportional terms compared to our.
Yeah, this is the incarceration capital, even more than in southern cities.
And Susan, not time to do justice to this, but also in a preventative kind of way, intervening when children are at risk, when they're living in violent households, when they're the victim of sexual or physical abuse. It seems that that's also an important thing to think about.
I believe that, it is an important thing to think about. And, you know, I want to get on the back of the last comment and talk about the advocacy and the leadership development that is a part of the model of a new way of life, and also thinking about how do we begin to create entrepreneurial opportunities for people who have the entrepreneurial spirit that are coming back into the community as a piece of this. So,
I hear you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm going to give Jean the last word only because I'm looking at the clock here, and there was a question about young women. Is there something that we should know or think about when it comes to young women who've gotten caught up in the criminal justice system?
I think when it comes to young women, you know, it's, again, sort of what Susan said, this stuff isn't hard. You know, it's sort of thinking intuitively. You know, young women need mentorship. They're going to need therapy. You know, they're going to need a bit more sort of care and individualized attention. And just to the recent points that both Susan and Marie made, you know, while there isn't a new way of life exactly here in Philadelphia, there are a lot of really remarkable programs here. And that's what the Reentry Project was created to do. It's a collaborative news project, www.thereentryproject.org, that looks exactly at how can we solve the problem of recidivism and who's doing it here in Philadelphia.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Susan Burton, a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yeah, very welcome. And the book is called Becoming Ms. Burton, and her program is called A New Way of Life. Jean Friedman-Rudofsky, thank you for joining us as well. And she's project editor of the Reentry Project. And my thanks to Marie Gottschalk for joining us, talking about mass incarceration and criminal justice, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks to all three of our guests. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.